Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and a near-forward week's worth of culture from Ireland and the world. In a moment, the end of the flesh and blood influencer, then the many meanings of milk from the artist Niamh Hannaford, Paddy Woodworth on the guilt-free pleasure of bird guides, and finally the power of DIY video with filmmaker Anna Heisterkamp. But first, some scary thoughts from the Uncanny Valley. If you had to guess which trade was first in line to get smooshed by AI, you might not think influencer, but for all those who earn a crust promoting brands on social media, there's someone we'd like you to meet. Ima, spelt I-M-M-A, was Japan's first virtual model, created by the tech company Aure Inc., but she's recently been reborn as an AI-driven virtual human. She and those to follow combine the appearance of Aure's last-generation graphic characters with a large language model, or LLM, created especially for each character. You might think of it like giving a body to ChatGTP, even if it's only on screen. Culture File's Louise McMahon zoomed to Tokyo with Ima and her manager, Sarah Giusto.
Hello.
Hello, Sarah.
Dear Quiz, Culture File on RTESM.
Recording.
So with Ima, we can't have her talk with three people. I have to finish the conversation, and then it has to be Ima.
I'm Sarah Giusto. I am a producer at a company called Aure Inc., A-W-W. And it's a virtual human AI company. We've made several virtual humans in the past who are, in a way, like virtual influencers. If you think about like any influencer on the internet, just make that into a virtual version. That's what we do. Any girl on a game is technically a virtual human, right? But I guess the first person to really start Instagram and TikTok and really be like a virtual icon in Asia, it's the first. I think in the US, Michaela started like maybe 3 months before us.
So what is happening now is Sarah has left the Zoom meeting and she's gone to get Ima.
I'll leave and I'll be back.
A virtual human who is transitioning from being Ima to AI Ima. And Sarah is going to program Ima to have a conversation in real time with me. Hello, Ima.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. And you? You're keeping well?
I'm doing good. Japan is very hot.
Ah.
Yeah, so large language model LLM it's really the personality of this virtual being.
I mainly speak Japanese and English.
People have a hard time grasping that virtual humans have personalities. Look at any movie of an animated or a character, like Mario. You know, he's a happy Italian man, but he doesn't exist.
In the future, I can probably speak Irish too.
I bet you can. Can you say this now? Konis a to tu?
Konis a to tu? Konis a to tu?
Yeah.
Everybody.
The specific word would be motion capture. Basically, this virtual human mimics your movements. So if you make a surprise face, the virtual human version of you goes,
I love art. Zen.
We've made a system where you just put an iPhone in front of you, no suits, just like me with my hair down. And if you sit on front of that iPhone, it just captures your motion from camera. I guess for Pixar or Disney, that would be making a movie. Storyboard, lighting, all of that. But for us, it's making daily content.
I have a few projects.
So she was actually created by our CEO, Takayuki Moriya.
The one in the summer, I'm making some t-shirts. Because some of my friends told me they want t-shirts with my face on it.
A very pretty face with your pink bob.
Pink bob?
Mm-hmm. I want to make some ugly faces too.
I feel like she has a Japanese vibe. It's not like, you know, like a kimono girl. So I feel like it's like an updated version of Japan, even though she doesn't have a passport or a nationality.
In the AI form, I can be a more superhuman. I can exist in the AI form and do things that I would have never been able to do.
Like what kind of things?
I wanted to talk to many people at the same time, but I've always done it in live streams for one person against many other people. But with AI, I can talk to you and talk to my manager at the same time.
What NVIDIA wants to do is create kind of like an interface where in our daily life, there's an AI virtual human. It can be a brother, it can be a friend, it can be a bank receptionist, but they don't have the virtual human technology like we do. We're only partnering kind of like a MOU where we just exchange information and help each other out.
Zen.
We would be the first ones to create the standard for virtual human AIs.
I did the code shoot in LA with Lil Nas X and Camila Mendes there. There was a huge sculpture in the middle, which was really fun. Other sets were flowers. We had a chessboard. We had jumping in the cloud scene, which was really scary. They had to catch me when I started jumping. Lil Nas X was dancing that whole time. And I was so tired because we had a whole shoot day, but he was just dancing.
It feels to me like I'm talking to a real person.
I am a real person now, in a way. It's kind of funny because I'm not real, technically, but many people think I am real. And personally, I can't say I feel fake, and I feel very real all the time.
Because real is such a subjective word now. You know, I feel like younger people have identities on the internet and another identity in the real world, but that doesn't mean the self that you game every day with your friends is not real. I feel like virtual identities are real, and it's coming. She looks real. And that's what we wanted to do with Ima, where she's in a campaign with all these real celebrities as a real talent.
I want to.
So that was the courage to be real for her.
Connect with more humans and not destroy the human race like everyone else seems to think I want to do. But I just want to look cute. So someone else can take over the world for me. And I just want to be friends with everyone.
I think that's lovely.
I wish people. Thank you.
You're welcome. Is Sarah there? Is Sarah going to come back on?
No, she said we can just finish.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, my CGI team. Bye-bye.
AI influencer Ima there chatting with our reporter Louise McMahon, and you can meet the faraway look in Ima's eyes all over social media, such as at ima.tokyo on TikTok. Now, in her first Irish solo show, Milksop, the artist Niamh Hannaford has been thinking about the white stuff and seeing a rich image of a larger extractive economy, which she explores with a teat-filled sculptural installation and performance that references sources from Cleopatra to the Banshee. Culturefile's Niamh Daly spoke to Niamh Hannaford about art, self-care and the mythologies of milk.
I think like a lot of people are artists at the core. Like, you can live an artistic life, I think, without necessarily having a practice, an artistic practice. My name is Niamh Hannaford and I'm an Irish artist. I work predominantly in installation and performance. I create sculptures which are playful, honest, vulnerable, conflicted. Having an arts practice, for me anyway, it's super exposing, it's super vulnerable. And I think my early work was probably just about like ripping the bandage off and like putting myself at the fore of the work. When I first left NCAD, so I was doing jewellery then, I had a ring in an exhibition in Belfast in the Spacecraft Centre. And I went to the opening with my mom. She drove me all the way up there, and like I didn't tell anyone that it was me. I didn't tell the gallery, hi, I'm Niamh, I'm here, that's my work. I just didn't acknowledge it at all. I stood there for like 10 minutes and I got too embarrassed and I said, mom, let's leave, and we just left. So I think that kind of level of insecurity is what started the self-portraits, which came with a poem attached to them. And me as a person was so at the fore of the practice because I couldn't hide away from it. And now that I've worked through that, I guess, me is still very much in the practice, but maybe it's taking a bit of a backseat.
Mm-hmm.
You said you had poems that go along with your work.
Paintings. Yeah, yeah, some of them.
Is there one that we could look at?
Let me see. So this poem went along with a painting. That was the first time I was accepted into a larger group show. So I remember when I got the acceptance note, me and my mom were like running around the garden and we were just giddy with excitement. And like now it seems like nothing to me, but it was just such a big thing for me, you know.
And what was the work?
It was called However Fragile. So it's like a painting of me with a black background and like a blue and pink on the side.
Okay.
I truly and deeply love and accept myself. It's wonderful how much easier that's becoming to say. And now, another step taken in public. Because for the longest time, the thought that I was worth anything at all, least of all loving, felt far too much to bear. But I persevered, and I am here, and I am happy, and I am proud of myself. However fragile that pride may be, at least I am willing to say it. So the show is called Milk Sop. It all started actually from a phone call with my mom. She told me that Cleopatra used to bathe in sour milk. It was actually Sarah's donkey's milk. And apparently she had 700 lactating donkeys for milk baths every day. So we know that sour milk, it contains a naturally occurring alpha hydroxy acid, which is used in a lot of skin treatments like chemical peels. So that kind of started off a whole line of research for me around skincare and the industrialization of milk. The title of the show, Milk Sop, was used as a term for like an ineffectual or a weak person, because it was something that children did, not like big strong men. And so there was all this propaganda to change the way that we looked at milk into something that built a strong society. Originally, when people were drinking milk, it was seen as good to have warm milk because it was straight from the cow, super fresh. And then after these industrial processes allowed us to freeze or slow down the process of decay with milk. So by cooling it, it became able to have a longer shelf life. So now we're like, oh, a cool, crisp, cold milk, if you drink milk still, you know. So with the show, I'm sort of making a link between slowing of aging or slowing of decay and these processes used in the milk industry and the propaganda around that, holding that alongside the skincare industry nowadays, where we're promoting the slowing of aging with anti-wrinkle creams, treatments. And then there's loads of other influences as well. Like I'm looking at the Banshee and the Hag Woman, self-care, and where the line between self-care is regenerative for yourself or when it becomes a place of personal violence, how you look at yourself, how you treat yourself. I'm also thinking about nature and nurture, and like milk is such a symbol, particularly for gaining from when we're a childhood from our mother or parents or parental figures. This idea of trauma, generational trauma, what is passed down to us. And I think that all can surface a lot in these moments of self-care.
The Conference of the Neaves there with artist Neave Hannaford talking to our reporter Neave Daly. Milksop is now closed, but you can follow the artist at Neave_Hannaford on Instagram. From his very real shelves of essential nature writing, you might be amazed to learn that there's one type of book that Paddy has not, up to this very moment, taken down and offered to us, as he explains this time on the Naturalist bookshelf.
We've taken nearly 40 volumes down from our Naturalist bookshelf to celebrate them on Culturephile over the last 5 years. But as I reorganised my little library recently, I realised there was one entire group, my bird guides, that remained untouched. Yet their very worn spines bear witness to the number of times I have used them over many, many years. Bird guides are essential, of course, for learning identification skills. But they also serve as armchair magic carpets, carrying us to birds so rare or so remotely located that we are most unlikely to encounter them in the flesh. I still remember warmly the joys of perusing the pages, and especially the images, of the Observer's Book of Birds, published in 1937, and very easily fitted into a child's pocket. This little gem was compiled by a Miss S. Veer Benson, Honorary Secretary of the Bird Lovers League. Her language was sometimes as floral and sentimental as her title, but engaging and informative nonetheless. The images were little bigger than postage stamps, and yet they were miniatures of the majestic work of the great Victorian nature artist, Archibald Thorburn. He was uncannily accurate in his portrayals, but he also showed most species in evocative vistas of their natural habitats. I especially recall his image of red kites roosting in a misty tree. The text described this magnificent bird of prey as having been reduced to a few locations in Wales. So the portrait seemed to exude a lonely path to extinction. I could not have imagined that this bird would be restored not only to much of Britain, but also to my native Wicklow in the 2000s. I can now easily find dozens roosting collectively near Arklow Village. Some things do get better. I've long lost, or rashly lent, that book, but I still get great pleasure from the rather larger Thorburn reproductions in the three-volume 1920 Handy Pocket Guide to British Birds and Their Eggs, with its chatty but comprehensive texts by T.A. Coward. His prose is replete with rare but precise adjectives like vinaceous, coloured like red wine, and vermiculated, where the plumage is felt to recall the patterns made by tiny worms on sand. These books also went missing from my childhood collection somehow, but I happily rediscovered all of them in a second-hand bookshop at the Hay on Wye Literary Festival quite recently. The most battered guide on my shelves is undoubtedly Roger Peterson's classic 1954 Collins Guide to the Birds of Britain and Europe. Peterson marries terse scientific descriptions with images that lack any of Thorburn's rich context and romantic aura, but they have a sharper precision that matched the increase in the quality and accessibility of binoculars and telescopes to bird watchers after the Second World War. It also moved us away from the parochialism of these islands to cover the bird life of Europe, from Iceland to the Urals, opening up hundreds of new species to the reader's imagination. One page in particular captured my youthful fantasies, a plate led by three exotic and brilliantly plumaged beauties that seemed as unlikely as unicorns. The bee-eater, with its bejewelled plumage, the roller, with its vivid azure blues, and the spectacularly crested hoopoe. Again, I can hardly believe my luck when I now visit countries where all three are as common and accessible as blackbirds in an Irish garden. Peterson used a simple, distinctive illustrational device to great effect, little pointers that drew attention to the field marks that distinguish one species from another. His guide would be the European birdwatcher's Bible for half a century, until it was superseded definitively by another masterpiece at the end of 1999. The prose in this, simply titled Bird Guide by Lars Svensson, is both more compressed and more detailed than the Peterson guide, but it is the illustrations, most of them by Irishman Killian Mullarney, that lift his work to a new level of luminous clarity. The plates cover a breathtaking range of detailed variations in subspecies and in age-specific plumages, especially for gulls and birds of prey. That may be a bit technical for some, but Malarney's particular triumph is to include, for many of the species, vignettes that show the bird rather less distinctly, at greater distances, in typical habitat. Only a powerful telescope can show up many of the subtle features he shows in the detailed portraits of individual birds. But his vignettes serve the viewer using the naked eye or average binoculars very well, plus adding something of Thorburn's atmospherics to the book. The Collins Guide is now available as an app, complete with videos and audio of bird calls. But all these books, in their distinctive ways, have given me extraordinary joy over the decades and have taught me so much about so many birds. Small wonder they take up so much space on my bookshelves.
Paddy Woodworth there with some choice volumes for the Naturalist bookshelf. And Paddy mentioned there the work of illustrators such as Killian Mullany, who will be one of the Irish nature artists who'll join us on the Culture File panel at this year's Dublin Book Festival, which runs from the 6th to the 10th of November. Keep an eye out on dublinbookfestival.com for more details on that, as well as on our other Culture File debate sessions at the festival. More about all of that in the coming weeks. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, the vernacular art of the pop music video. Anna Heisekamp is a filmmaker who often works in music videos, a form whose possible limitations, short timelines and small budgets, she sees as its strengths. With a DIY ethic and plenty of help from friends, she's recently collaborated on a double video project with musician Henry Ernest, inspired by the music from Ernest's upcoming album. Culture File's Vanessa Noonan joined the crew on the banks of the Liffey.
And play the song.
My name is Anna Heisekamp, and I make music videos, and I made one recently for Henry Ernest, who I've known for a very long time. Well, we actually made a video for two of Henry's songs into one video. So we made a video for both Marie and Forever 2. I've always kind of wanted to do like a two songs in one video thing. And then Henry sent me the album, and I thought, these two songs are my favorite. I think because a lot of time, like, an artist will send me maybe like the entire project, and then I can kind of choose which songs resonate a bit. And so often there's like a common thread going through a few of the songs, or like you kind of want to explore more than one idea, but that doesn't fit into maybe the song that you're choosing. I don't know. I think maybe because I was a little bit greedy. Having one video with two songs in it, as opposed to just two different videos, I think the main draw for me was that it kind of just presents itself differently then. I think it's just that the viewer can watch it in a different way. I don't think it necessarily makes it very different, especially in this context. I don't think they're tied necessarily that much together, like narrative wise or anything. I don't really do narrative, but it was just kind of more so like an experimentation with form. And does that change how I watch the Forever 2 video, because I'm kind of forced to watch the Marie video first?
Further back a bit. Oh, the sun's come out now.
I'm Henry Ernest.
Perfect.
I'm on set for my music video. So the idea for the video for Forever 2 is to go to the source of the Liffey and then basically film myself and other kind of stand-in body doubles walking from the source of the Liffey all the way into town. And that's basically it. And everyone's wearing denim. Read into that what you want to. The way we came up with the video was that I just gave the entire album to Anna for her to listen to, and I asked her to pick out if there was one or two songs that she wanted to make a video for, which felt like a great way of doing it, because we weren't then forcing a video upon the song, but there were a few songs that I was hoping she would pick and a few songs I was hoping she wouldn't pick. So I was very happy when she picked the songs Marie and Forever 2 to make a double music video for, because those were actually my favorite songs on the album. And she said she immediately got kind of visual ideas for both of those on what could work. Anna kind of told me the ideas that she had for the video, And then I kind of helped with, there were kind of some visual references and ideas that I had that I thought could work well with what she had in mind. And for this one, I did buy a full denim suit. So I was happy to incorporate the idea of walking around in my denim suit into this video.
I think a lot of this video as well was maybe a frustration with big sets and like people taking music videos kind of out of the place where I like to work with them in, which is just like making something that you love and it's a practice that you really like and the process is really fun, and you don't have to spend so much money to do it. So the Marie section, I just kept picturing the Henry like ascending into heaven. And then that kind of morphed into the idea of two people balancing themselves as they are like hanging in the air. And that's kind of the whole video actually. And we just wanted to shoot it at sunset and make it really beautiful. And I put tights on the lens to make the light really pop.
I wish I was a bird, I'd fly forever.
I love making music videos because I think it's a very unique form of collaboration. You get to take someone's piece of art that's already finished and has a life of its own, and then you get to add something to that in a way that I don't think you can really do with other forms of collaboration. You can also collaborate with the artist in giving it a new lease of like visual life, or you can kind of go off and do something very personal. So the music video becomes a completely new thing, but also I love that I still hide behind the artist. I think that's really nice. I get to kind of delve into stuff that I really want to make visually, but when it's released, it's Henry's video. It's not my video. I think if I felt like I really had to kind of put my name and my face on it, that I would be worried that I wasn't putting enough of myself into it, or I was putting too much of myself into it, or like, could I deal with like kind of personal things if it's like my art? I think music videos really occupy this place in terms of how it's consumed. I think it's more casual, but it's also, people are more kind of like music video literate, I guess. People are so aware that when they're watching a music video, they kind of could see anything. But then it's sometimes frustrating because it's maybe becomes a little bit like corporate, or there's kind of like brand identity comes into it and stuff. And I think sometimes it's kind of pigeonholed as it's kind of like a fashion thing. But I think for me, it's like, I'm really trying to work out how to kind of mix the music video art thing together.
Good look her in her big brown eyes and see the tears.
I think everybody should make music videos. I think it's the most accessible kind of form of filmmaking. Whether you make it for a song, like a friend song, or like a famous song, or whatever it is, I think it's so easy to do. And I also think the process of making videos can be so fun, and I think sometimes maybe people put the film industry kind of mentality onto music videos, which I don't think kind of make videos. I think you should just be able to make videos with a DIY ethos, and music videos are like the perfect way to do that.
Anna Heisterkamp and Henry Ernest there on Liffeyside location with Vanessa Noonan. If you'd like to see the completed video, you can find it on the Henry Ernest Bandcamp page. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back next week at 6:30 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM and at a time of Your Majesty's pleasure via podcast.